ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Tom Robinson was a 14-year-old living in the Brisbane suburbs and going to high school when he woke up one morning, looked in the mirror, and said to himself, "Tom, you're going to row a boat across the Pacific Ocean and you're going to be the youngest person ever to do it." For the next 9 years, everything Tom did was in service of achieving that dream. He trained as a boat builder and handcrafted his own traditional wooden boat for the journey. And in 2022, aged 23, Tom set off from Lima, escorted by well-wishers in yachts and a Peruvian naval brass band. What lay ahead of him was a distance of nearly 8,000 nautical miles, that's nearly 14,000 kilometres of the Pacific Ocean, which he would row his boat across day after day after day. Tom had no support crew or even music to keep him company. Instead, he encountered curious whales, constant sharks, wild storms, the starry sky at night, and astonished but welcoming villagers once he made it to the islands of the South Pacific after 5 full months at sea. Tom's incredible journey feels like an adventure from a bygone age, and it earned him the Polynesian name Mahuta Hoho Asanga, the warrior that has paddled from afar. Hi, Tom.
Hey, how are you?
How was my Polynesian pronunciation there?
Not bad, not bad.
How do you say it?
Mahuta Hoho Asanga.
That sounds much better. You grew up in Brisbane, as I say. Who first introduced you to boats?
I guess my dad had always been a boating person. And so I was first introduced to boats when I was a young kid, probably 8 or 9. He had a little sailing boat and we'd go out sailing and I hated every minute of it.
You hated every minute?
Yeah, there was something about it being outside and outdoors and I didn't like it one bit. And then it all changed when I moved suburbs as a kid and we lived near the river. And he had this little plywood boat that he'd built for us, so we'd take it on holidays as kids at the beach and stuff. And I rediscovered this boat under the house and all of a sudden this was my machine and my freedom. And so I used to go on these grand adventures for hours on end after school had finished, rowing up and down the river, catching fish and meeting characters that lived on their boats in the river, and became my transport to and from school every day. And that was my little slice of freedom.
Were your parents ever worried about you being out on the river by yourself?
When I was just rowing to and from school, I don't think they were, but as I got a little bit older and I started to go on longer journeys, I think they were concerned, but they always gave me that freedom that I was chasing.
So it was freedom. What else was special for you about being out on the river as a teenager?
It was the peace and quiet and the escape from it all. So it's amazing. You live in the suburbs in Brisbane and there's cars and traffic and people and it's all happening. And you jump in a little boat on the river and you've got this big long stretch and it's almost empty. You can't see anyone, see any cars, see any people, can't hear anything. It's the peace and the meditation of it all. It's just so hard to find in the suburbs, but I found it there and it was just fantastic.
And you're a triplet too, so I imagine life inside the house could get a little chaotic.
Yes, that's right. Two sisters the same age as me who both have very strong opinions on matters, as do I. And so, and those opinions never gelled, of course. We all had differing opinions. And so, it was always crazy at home, quite intense a lot of the time, to be honest. And so to be able to escape all that and be at peace with myself on the river was something that I was so lucky to have.
So tell me, Tom, about this moment when you were 14 and made a promise to yourself.
Up until then, obviously, I'd been rowing a lot, rowing to and from school and doing it on the weekends as well. And each night I'd go home and I'd read books about explorers and adventurers and sailors. And I was feeling really wholly inspired by these books. And I knew that I had to find an adventure that would suit me, something that I could pin my hopes and dreams on, basically, from that young age. And there was always this fascination with the Pacific and the people of the islands in the Pacific. And then after some time, I sort of came to this conclusion and I woke up in the morning, looked myself in the mirror and said, "Tom, you're going to become the youngest person ever to row across the Pacific Ocean and you're going to design and build yourself a boat for that journey." And that was it. And I never really once wavered from that goal.
Did Did you tell your family, friends?
I told everyone, yeah. And I think at the time my parents sort of rolled their eyes and said, yeah, it'll be a different thing next week, Tom. But I stuck to it. And even as a kid growing up, I was always known as, this is Tom who's going to row across the Pacific. That was my sort of introduction.
What was your first long solo row?
That was the same year when I was 14, and it was sort of all in preparation for this Pacific trip. But I decided that I would row from where my parents lived at Indooroopilly down to the Gold Coast. And so I found this old wooden boat, and my dad helped me fix it up, and we made a little sleeping area, and we put a sliding seat in it and storage compartments and lights and all the things you need for a little expedition. And I set off one day, and then 5 days later I called my dad and said, I'm at the Gold Coast, can you come and pick me up? And in a couple of hours he was down there. And
so just 14, sleeping alone on a boat at night, rowing. I mean, what was the experience like for you?
Even before I'd left the river, there was dolphins around the boat and there was fish about, and I was just felt like I was on this real boy's adventure, and I was meeting people along the way, and I was rowing really hard, and there was strong winds that would push me back sometimes, and it just had all these elements of a great little expedition and adventure, and I was out there alone, and I enjoyed every minute of it.
Rowing from your parents' house at Indooroopilly to the Gold Coast, though, is a different order of magnitude than rowing from Peru to Australia.
Yes, yes, yeah, correct. I thought it was a good little stepping stone.
For that bigger journey, you had this vision of a boat. Why did you want to build your own boat?
I think I saw this whole journey as an aesthetic experience. It wasn't just about the physical endurance or the challenge of solitude. It was about having this beautiful experience. And I knew that time alone at sea, was there was going to be a lot of beauty in that. There was going to be a lot of beauty in my time in the islands, I hoped. And so the designing of the boat, which started with a pencil and paper and carving a model.
So you designed the boat yourself as well?
Yeah, I started with a block of wood and carved the model, and then it turned into a full-size boat. That whole process was all about it being truly individual for me, and this whole experience being my journey. I didn't just buy a boat. I didn't go to a school and learn how to row and all these sorts of things. I taught myself how to do these things, learn how to build boats, learn how to design them. And then so this whole journey was mine.
With this boat that you designed and built, what did it look like?
So Maywa, as she's named, and Maywa is the Aboriginal name for the Brisbane River. So she's a 24-foot long, double-ended whale boat. So the design for the boat came from the whale boats that were traditional boats used all around the world, especially in North America, to hunt the whales in the Pacific. And I'd spent years dreaming of this ideal boat, and I was flicking through this old book one day, and there was these plans for a whale boat from about the 1860s. And all of a sudden I realised that everything I'd been thinking about and dreaming about was in these hull lines here. And I read the description about this boat, and it was used with oarsmen in the Pacific to catch whales. And so this hull shape was perfect. And of course, the hull shape's now 150 years old, but the sea hasn't changed in that time, and rowing hasn't really changed in that time. And so still now that hull shape was perfect for what I wanted to do. I had to change it slightly because I was solo as opposed to having a team of six, and then I added a cabin to it, and the materials I used were a bit more modern. There were some epoxy glues in there to hold it all together. But by and large, it was a very traditional boat.
And did you have space, as you said, you know, you're going to be spending all this time in it, you wanted it to feel homely, comfortable. What kind of space was there for you to say, lie down in or rest in?
Sure, yeah. So there was, in the middle of the boat's a cockpit, and that's where I sat and I rowed, and that's just an open deck area. So that's where I spent 8 to 10 hours every day. The aft end, or the back end of the boat, was all storage, and then in the front of the boat, in the forward cabin, was a little tiny cabin, no bigger than, say, a one-man tent, and that was just big enough for me to sit up and then lie down and sleep, to cook, to navigate, and to store the rest of my gear for the trip.
What kind of navigation equipment did you have?
It was a traditional boat, and rowing across the Pacific is a pretty traditional way to go about it. And so I wanted to try and navigate traditionally as well. And so before I left, I searched high and low to find an old mariner who knew how to use a sextant, which is a traditional instrument used by sailors up until about the 1970s and 80s to measure the angle between the horizon and the heavenly bodies, the sun or the stars. So I found this old fisherman and he taught me how to use this sextant. And so my father gave me his old sextant that he'd forgotten how to use. And I took it on this journey, and I did take a GPS as well, so I did know where I was exactly at all times if need be. But there was this great pleasure of being out there alone with a sextant and knowing that if all the GPSs fell out of the sky tomorrow or I lost all my batteries, I'd still be able to get to an island.
How long did you think this trip was going to take? What was the plan?
The plan originally was to spend 9 months crossing the Pacific, and I figured something like 200, 250 days at sea and then a few weeks in each island or a couple of weeks in each island. And then all of a sudden this thing called COVID happened while I was planning this trip, and so all the timeframes blew out, and just trying to get my boat in a container to send it to Peru took something like 5 months, and then it jumped on all these different ships to get there. So it was this big, long process. That meant that I missed the window for the cyclone season. So leaving Peru, I knew that I was going to have to lay over for 4 months on an island in the Pacific. And that sort of changed the whole sort of idea of the trip. And it was more now about spending time in these places I got to and enjoying myself.
So you sent your boat off to Peru. Why Lima as the starting point for this journey?
So I decided to cross the Pacific from east to west because the currents and the trade winds push that way. So it would be impossible to leave from Australia in a rowing boat to get that way. I chose Lima because they were friendly and welcoming. Originally, I was going to leave from Chile, which is a bit further south, which would have been a bit more advantageous. But it was very hard to make inroads there. The Navy didn't like the idea of someone leaving their country in a rowing boat. And I was able very quickly to make great connections with people in Lima, in Peru, and they were very welcoming and they opened their arms to me and they couldn't have done more to help me. They were just fantastic.
When you arrived in Lima, Tom, did you head off straight away, get in your boat and go?
No. There was this 2 month period there, and I expected maybe a few weeks, but I got there and then all of a sudden my boat hadn't been released from customs. So there was a month of trying to get my boat out of customs, and it ended up in this big sort of bribe I had to pay just to get it out. So there was challenges there, but that month being in Peru without a boat was just amazing. I was on a holiday for the first time ever. It was like I could do what I wanted, and everyone knew that I was this guy turning up to row across the Pacific, and so it was easy to make friends. And that first month was just wonderful.
So how do you remember feeling the night before setting off?
I was so focused on that next 48 hours that I don't think there was time for nerves particularly. I knew that things had to happen that next morning. I had to get my passport stamped. I had to pack the boat. I had to make sure I left the coast properly. I had to make sure I packed everything, said goodbye to everyone that I needed to say goodbye to. So it was definitely a process, and there wasn't really enough time for fear. I knew that it was happening and that was it.
What did you have for breakfast?
Dos pan con chicharrón.
So, is that pork?
Pan con chicharrón is like these fantastic pork buns with sweet potato. And so I'd have two of them every morning from the lady at the maqueta, whose name I never got, but she knew I was leaving and she gave me a big hug and gave me a stern talking to in Spanish, of which I understood nothing, but I understood the sentiment.
What about once you got into your boat? Was there anyone there to see you off?
Yeah, it was this amazing feeling. The morning I left, I was hosted by the yacht club in Peru. And the morning of, there was a few people sort of mulling about and there was this real sense of excitement. And then this brass band arrives and I looked at the yacht club manager and sort of questioning him, and he gave me this wry smile. And so I realised that they were for me. And then all of a sudden, all these boats sort of started to appear from the rowing clubs, all the schools from the rowing clubs, and all these pleasure yachts and naval craft, and we're all waiting and waiting. Eventually, the customs officials turn up and they stamp my passport and everyone cheers, and I get onto my boat and I pull up the anchor and I take that first pull of the oars, the second stroke, totally focused, but around me is this great flotilla of all these rowing boats, these naval people, pleasure yachts, and there's this brass band in this launch playing all these classically Peruvian songs. I couldn't help but kind of dance and jive a bit, and then I focused once again and just got into this process of rowing and rowing and rowing.
What an amazing send-off. But, I mean, as you kept rowing, all those pleasure crafts and well-wishers and the naval band, they drift back. Head back to shore and you're still going.
Yep. One by one, these boats leave until there's one boat left. And that was the boat of my dear friend, Gonzalo Rivago, who took me under his wing as soon as I got there and did so much for me to make sure that I got to the start line, basically. And there was tears in everyone's eyes as he finally waved goodbye and turned around, and I was left alone with one sea lion swimming alongside. And that was it. I knew that I wasn't going to see anyone again for a very long time.
So what was a typical day during this first leg?
I'd wake up in the morning with the sun and have some breakfast. So that was a bowl of oats. It was the same thing every day.
No more pork buns.
No more pork buns, unfortunately. So I'd have my oats with a little bit of sugar if I was feeling generous. And then I'd jump on the oars and I'd start rowing. And I'd row and row and row until probably about 11 o'clock. By this stage, it would get too hot to row. So when I was up near the equator, the sun's wickedly hot up there. And so I'd retire to the cabin for an hour or two sort of to have a siesta. I'd do some navigating with my sextant, or I'd catch a fish, or I'd just have a snooze even, make some lunch, then back on the oars maybe 12:30, 1 o'clock, and then I'd row all the way until it got dark at 6 o'clock at night, basically 6:30 or 7. In between, I'd have the odd short break to just to stop for 10 minutes and eat a muesli bar. Then at night, I'd hang up the oars, and I'd retire to the cabin and I'd make some dinner, which was usually a dehydrated meal, which I left Brisbane Airport with 6 suitcases full of dehydrated food, and I made it all the way to to Peru with them, thankfully. And then I would sleep all night.
And how well would you sleep on a calm night?
On a calm night, I would sleep like a baby. The best sleep that I'd ever had and ever will have. The boat sort of just gently rocked me to sleep, and it was just beautiful. And on the rough nights, it was quite the opposite.
How quickly did you experience rough weather?
Not long after leaving Peru, like in the first sort of few days, it got quite rough quite quickly. So I was sort of thrown in the deep end there, and it was sort of cold and everything was new. The boat was very heavy because there was so much food and water on board. And so these waves, instead of picking the boat up, would kind of just dump inside the boat. And so it was rough. And I'd wake up in the morning sometimes and there'd be these strange fish from the deep sea that had come up at night and they'd been washed into the boat.
You mentioned that you were eating fish as well as all the stores you'd bought. How easy was it to catch fish?
Yes, in that eastern part of the Pacific on the first leg of the journey, it's just full of life. And so most of the time it was as easy as pointing to the fish that looked the tastiest and then casting out my rod and winding it in and the fish jumping onto that lure. And so I ate very well.
Is it like you anticipated? You'd been dreaming of this for 9 years. What was the experience like once it's actually begun?
That first sort of 75 days rowing across the Pacific, it was this great feeling of like I was being out there at sea, like I dreamed about it. And when I was a kid, I always read this book called The Contiki by this famous adventurer and explorer, Thor Heyerdahl. And he'd rafted across the Pacific from Lima in a balsa wood raft in 1947. And so 75 years after he left, almost to the day I departed from the same yacht club he did, we had a similar farewell. And I was out there and I was rereading his book and we were in the same spots and I was experiencing just the same things, the fish jumping, the sunsets, the stars at night. So 75 years after my hero, Thor Heyerdahl, had done his journey, I was out there in my own little boat experiencing the same thing, and the wonder and amazement from having a dream come true like that is just fantastic.
It sounds like you're kind of in bliss, Tom, but what changed after 75 days rowing?
I left Peru, not knowing exactly where I was going to end up for the first leg, but knowing roughly. And there's an island group called the Marquesas, and they're often the first port of call for yachts crossing the Pacific. And so I had this rough plan to get to these islands. I figured it would take about 100 days. I packed food for about 150. And the whole while I'd been rowing on this first leg, I was a fair way further north than I wanted to be. Despite the fact that I was trying to row south every single day, these strong breezes kept pushing me north. Just before I left, I had a phone call with one of the handful of other people that have done this journey solo. Maybe there's only 5 or 6. And he said to me, "Don't worry, Tom, you can't miss those Marquesas Islands. The current just pushes you there." So after about 70 days, the current had started to push me straight towards these islands, and I was feeling really confident about the fact that I was going to get there. I was going to have enough food and water. Things were looking great. And then just about day 75, this strong southeasterly breeze picked up, and it began to blow and blow and blow harder and harder and harder. And I'd row south as hard as I could each day, but every morning when I checked my position, I'd be pushed further north and further north, away from these islands. And this sinking feeling came into me. And on day 75, I woke up and it just hit me like a ton of bricks, and I realised that there was no hope of me reaching these islands, and that this whole first leg had just changed just like that overnight. And like a madman, I went into my cabin and I pulled out all my charts of the Pacific and I scanned these charts looking for any tiny little dots that were islands. And it was quite serious at this point because I knew I had to reach landfall in the coming month, otherwise cyclone season was going to start, and being alone at sea in a rowing boat during cyclone season is just a death wish.
And also, you're running out of water. You were carrying water with you.
Yeah, sure. I left Peru with 300 litres of water. I'd been rationing 2 litres a day. I had a desalination pump to turn salt into fresh if I needed it, but it's very slow going. And so there was all this mounting pressure of I need to get to land because of cyclone season, because of my rations. On and on it went. And I scanned these maps that I pulled out, these charts of the Pacific, and I found the Marquesas and I looked to the west. Where's the next island? Where's the next island? There was a little tiny speck I found, went to the pilot books and looked it up there, uninhabited. And that wasn't going to help me because I needed somewhere where I could survive for 4 months. And so I kept scanning until I found this little tiny dot called Pedron. I went to the pilot books, to the index P, and I went turned to the right page, and there was just one paragraph, and it said, Pedron Island, Atoll, Northern Cook Islands, 2 villages. And that was all I needed to know, that this place was inhabited. And so all of a sudden, everything changed, and I knew that I was aiming for this little tiny island called Pedron. So I did something very unusual then. I picked up a satellite phone for the first time to make a phone call. Up until then, I'd done the odd intermittent text to my parents at home and they texted me back. But other than that, no communication. And so I picked up the satellite phone and I made a call. I said, Mum and Dad, how are you? They said, we're not too bad. How are you? It was a very strange sort of conversation we had.
Been up to, yeah.
Yeah, that sort of thing. And I said, look, I'm not going to make these islands of the Marquesas. I'm going to aim for Pedron. I think it'll take me about 150 days to get there. I've got 150 days worth of food, so I'm just going to dig deep and keep rowing and hopefully I'll make it to this little tiny dot. They said, okay, well, best of luck, Tom. We'll see how you go. As I got closer to this island, I realised that it was going to be very dangerous to try and approach this island. My boat was a big, heavy boat, and these strong winds and waves push onto this island, and there's only a few little tiny entrances into the safe lagoon. And so it was going to be very dangerous for me to try and make landfall. And so I asked my family if they could try and get in contact with the people of this island and to see if they could send a boat out as I arrived to tow me in through the passages and into the lagoon. So they said, yes, they can do that for me. And so at that stage, all I had to do was get to that island.
Which is still, let's face it, a pretty big ask, a tiny speck in the middle of the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, and all of a sudden my first leg that I thought was going to be 4,000 miles became 5,000 miles. Pedron was another 1,000 miles away from the Marquesas. And so a big, big journey.
So what was that moment like when you saw land on the horizon?
It was the most amazing thing. It was like every book you've ever read about a sailor in a life raft or an explorer finding land for the first time. It was just like that. It was day 160. So I'd been at sea for 5 months. And by that stage, I was running low on just about everything. And I rowed and rowed and rowed. And I turned around and there was this little faint grey smudge on the horizon. I cried out, land ho! And I was just totally overcome by the fact that I was seeing land. There was still this fear within me that there was still a few miles to go to get there and there were so many unknowns. But as I got closer and closer and that grey smudge turned into a green smudge and then I saw coconut palms and I saw waves breaking on a beach and I realised that I'd made it and that I'd crossed half of the Pacific Ocean and that night I wasn't going to sleep in a boat in the ocean, I was going to sleep on a bed on the land.
Because it was a coral atoll, as you say, you can't just sort of land the boat on a sandy beach. Did someone come out and meet you? How did you
make it ashore? So I got close enough that I could see the island and I couldn't see any sign of life. It was looked very isolated and desolate. And then I got closer and closer and I saw this boat come towards me. It just appeared on the crest of a wave. And it got closer and closer and it was this big aluminium boat and it was full of these big brown, jolly, smiling people. And I threw them a tow rope and they said, hello, Tom, welcome to Pedron. And I said, thank you for having me. And they tied the tow rope onto the stern of their boat and we began this tow through the dangerous Eastern Pass and into the safety of the lagoon. We tied up alongside the coral wharf and the customs man came aboard and he stamped my passport and he said, Tom, you're free to step ashore now. Welcome to Pedron. And I looked at the coral wharf and I looked at my bare feet and I realised that I hadn't taken a step in 5 months. I took this great deep breath and I took this leap of faith, so to speak, and I felt my soft feet land on this hard cold ground, and there was this warmth with it. And I tried to walk straight, but I was like a drunk because I had the sea legs very bad. Luckily, there were all these men around me to sort of help me up and prop me up and shake my hand. And that was really the moment when I knew that I was safe and that I was going to be okay. This man in the village, he came up to me after I'd taken photos with a few people, and there was a bit of a scene there, and he came up to me and he said, "Tom, welcome to Penryn. You're the first international visitor we've had in 3 years, so it's a pleasure to have you here. But there's something I must inform you of." And he got very serious. And I said, "Oh, okay, what's this?" And he said, "Well, you came to this island as Tom Robinson, but you're no longer Tom Robinson. You are now Mahuta Hoi Hoi Asanga, which in our language means the warrior that has paddled from afar. So welcome to Penryn, Mahuta." And this wave of emotion came over me, and I couldn't believe it. From my childhood, I'd read books about these adventurers that had been given local names 150 years ago arriving to these islands. And here I was in 2023 arriving, and these people, without knowing a thing about me, not knowing if I was going to stay a day, a week, a month or a year, they took me in with open arms and they gave me a local name. And that'll stay with me for the rest of my life.
Where did you spend your first night at that island?
Yes, one of the men in the village took me to his home, and I can remember it so clearly because it was all so strange. And he's got his children there, and we sat down and there was a meal prepared, and we said grace, and then we ate this meal, and there was fish and rice and coconuts. And I didn't realise it then, but that's all I was going to eat for the next 4 months. But we had this fish and rice and coconuts, and it was just the most delicious thing. And after we finished our meal, the children all sat around on the floor and sang songs together and played the guitar. And then they showed me my bed where I was going to sleep that night, and they said, "Here's the shower, Tom." And so I had a shower for the first time in 5 months, and I laid down on this bed, and just this big sigh of relief came over me that I'd made it, and that there was no more fear about the weather coming and what tomorrow was going to look like and how much food I was going to have. It was, I've made it, and I can let my hair down.
This is where you waited out the cyclone season. How did you spend your time on the island?
I found out that these people that have almost nothing live these amazingly purposeful lives. So there's no resort on the island. There's no regular flights. There's a supply ship that comes every 4 months. There's no shopping centre. There's one room in this old papa's house, and he'll sell you some goods if you need them. But other than that, they lead these very simple, God-fearing, purposeful lives. And so I was always busy. It was either drumming practice or singing practice. There was fishing to do for the men. We had to get coconut fibres for the ladies to weave hats. Church was 5 times a week. Sunday school was twice on Sunday. There was always activities happening. Just if I wanted to ride my bicycle around the village or play with the kids or look after some kids, babysit them, there was always things to do.
Was there a part of you that didn't want to leave? I mean, this just sounds beautiful.
Yeah. I just discovered this paradise, the sort of thing I'd always been searching for. And so it was very difficult to leave, of course, but I had to continue on this journey.
So when the day came for you to set off again on the Maywa, how did it feel to be rowing? How was your body taking it?
That first day was very hard. The previous 4 months were active, but they weren't taxing, let's say. And so to jump back on those oars and to row away from the island as the whole village was in a boat singing as I rowed away was so, so hard. But deep down there was this purpose within me, and I knew that I'd started this journey to cross the Pacific, and so I was going to give it everything I had to complete that journey. Once again, I didn't know where I was going to get to next. I was thinking maybe Fiji. This is the great thing about adventuring in a rowing boat. Unlike being in a yacht where you can basically get to where you want to go, when you're in a rowing boat, you're at the mercy of the winds and the currents and the sea. And so it's truly an adventure when you leave one port and have no idea of which port you'll get to next. So I left Penryn unsure where I was going to get to next. I was thinking Fiji might be nice. And about halfway through that first leg, a couple of weeks in, I contracted this terrible staph infection on my legs. I had all these awful pussy wounds and sores appeared. It was very painful. At the time, I didn't really know what it was, but thankfully I had enough medication on board that I could keep the infection down and I got better. But still, I felt pretty crook for much of that second leg. And so I made the call to basically get to the next island I could get to. And that ended up being American Samoa after 38 days.
And how did they receive you? Was it the same kind of welcome?
These people didn't know I was arriving, which was this great excitement for me. And I found myself approaching Tutuila Island, which is this big, beautiful island. And for the first time in 11 months since I left South America, I could hear the sounds of land birds, not just atoll birds or seabirds. And I could see cars in the distance driving on these winding roads around this volcanic island. And I was just totally taken aback by these scenes of modernity and the beauty of it all. And I got closer and closer until I found myself approaching Whangaitua Bay. And by this stage, I was still pretty crook. I was pretty ill. And I managed to row straight up onto the beach. And I just laid there on the sand and contemplated the fact that I'd got there and I was safe once again. But it was this great euphoria of once again making landfall in this strange foreign place.
You spent a few weeks there recovering physically, and then the journey's only going to happen with you rowing. You set off again. What's the weather like in this part of the Pacific?
So leaving Samoa, I realised that I was going to be heading into a very rough part of the Pacific and a part where forecasting doesn't work that well because it's so unpredictable. And what I didn't realise was that I was setting off into what would become the hardest 52 days of the journey. That third leg there was really, really difficult. It was taxing. I didn't see any ships that whole time. It was sort of this lonely, lonely leg and a difficult one.
When the water was rough and there were big waves, Tom, what could you do to protect yourself?
There's two things I can do. One is put the sea anchor off the stern of the boat. So a sea anchor is a drogue, a cone-shaped piece of canvas that hangs in the water off the stern of the boat. That slows drift down and it keeps the stern, the back of the boat, pointed into the waves so you're not side on to the waves, mitigating the risk of capsize. And then I'd lock myself inside my cabin. And so I'd find these situations where I'd be locked in the cabin for like 6 hours and there would be this great storm around me and these huge waves smashing against the boat. And there's only 6 millimetres of plywood separating me from this inhospitable environment. And you can't sleep when it's this rough. The whole boat's rocking and it's so noisy and waves are crashing. And you say your prayers and you hope that you make it through the night.
And never in those points thought, why did I decide to do this thing?
Oh, many times. Yeah. Many, many, many times.
And a storm might last for hours at a time, seven hours.
Yeah, I never had a really bad storm that lasted days and days, but definitely there'd be like a 12-hour period where, or a 24-hour period even, where you couldn't row and you were inside that cabin because of the conditions.
Was your sense of what this journey was all about, was it starting to change by this point?
I think on that first leg of the journey, it encompassed everything that I needed it to. I didn't realise at the time leaving Lima that it wasn't about getting to the finish line. But when I did that first leg, I got to Pedran and I felt as though I'd ticked every box, so to speak. I'd experienced the highs and lows of being out there, this nirvana of being out there alone at sea. I experienced those high highs. I experienced these great lows of the difficulties that I faced. And coming to this island and meeting these people, I really did tick every box and I felt like I'd achieved everything that I needed to achieve. And so, especially on this third leg and then going into the fourth leg, by that stage it was just a case of, let's finish what I started.
Where was the next place that you made landfall after that really difficult, treacherous stretch?
So I found myself approaching Gawa and I hadn't planned on reaching Gawa, but that's the way the winds and the currents pushed me, and so I was there. And I just had this sort of rough outline on a big chart of the Pacific. There was Gawa and a little tiny anchor symbol on the northern coast. So I found myself rowing along this northern coast, and by this stage it was blowing quite strongly. It was getting to the afternoon, and I realised that if I didn't make a safe landfall that afternoon, then I would have no choice but to row back offshore away from the island and get to relative safety, as opposed to trying to hang out off this island while it's dark at night time, which is totally unsafe. So I was rowing along the northern coast of Gawa. And it's this great volcanic island with this fringing sandy beach, a little lagoon, and then a coral reef that fringes all the way around. And I knew I had to try and find an entrance through that coral reef and into the little tiny lagoon that surrounded the island. And I was rowing and rowing along this island, and I'd seen no sign of human life whatsoever. Even though I was quite close, there was no light post, no electricity, not even a sheet of corrugated iron, not a hut, nothing at all. I rowed and rowed and rowed, and then out of the corner of my eye, because as you row, you're facing backwards, obviously, and so you've got to keep turning your head. I turned my head, and out of the corner of my eye, I saw a thatched hut on the beach and a dugout canoe. As I got closer to it, this little boy appeared at the entrance of the hut, and he ran down onto the beach, and he pointed at me, and I pointed back at him. And then the next thing I did was I stood up and I put some pants on. And once I'd done that, as soon as I stood up, I could see that I'd rowed past a little tiny entrance through the breaking waves that I'd been rowing alongside. And I realised that I just missed this little tiny entrance and that there was a chance that I could make it through. Was I going to keep going and try and find a proper, safe anchorage, or was I going to turn around and risk it all and try and make it through this passage? And just as I was trying to make my mind up, this old man appeared from the hut, and him and the boy launched the canoe, and I realised that they were coming out to try and help me. And so I made that decision. I pulled the rudder hard over, and I got on these oars, and I pulled and I pulled, and this time I was rowing into the prevailing winds and currents, pounding through these waves, and I rowed and rowed and rowed until I got back to the entrance of this little tiny passage. And just to paint a picture, there's this coral reef around the island. There's big breaking waves. These waves roll uninterrupted across the Pacific, and then they hit these little tiny atolls, all these islands, and these waves crash on these coral reefs. And in behind the coral reef is this placid lagoon. Every so often through these coral reefs, you'll find a little tiny entrance. So I was aiming for this entrance. I got to the mouth of this entrance, which was no wider than the span of my oars, and the old man and the young boy in the canoe were beckoning me in with these enticing hand signals. They were trying to guide me through. In the space of 30 seconds, I'd made my way through and into this calm lagoon, and I was safe. I threw the anchor down, and it was this big sigh of relief. The old man paddles up to me, and he says, "Hello, my name is Victor, and this is the island of Gawa." I said, "Hello, Victor, my name's Tom. I've just rowed from Samoa." And, of course, he couldn't understand this whatsoever. And as Victor and I were speaking, there was this old lady clambering along the rocks along the beach, and she had a drinking coconut in one hand and a machete in the other, and she was husking this coconut. And he paddles ashore, and he gets this drinking coconut off this lady. He comes back out to me, and he said, "Tom, this is a gift from my wife. She had tears in her eyes for you." And he gives me this drinking coconut. It's the sweetest thing I've ever had. And I said, "Victor, fear not. I'm not a shipwrecked sailor in a lifeboat. I'm out here purposefully and intentionally." And he shook his head. He was very confused by the whole scenario, but he was happy to have me there. He lived isolated on this island, on this coast of the island, and it was probably, I think, like a 2-hour hike to get to the nearest hamlet, or by canoe, probably 5 hours to get to the little general store.
How long did you stay there for?
So I stayed outside Victor's house for about 7 days, and in that time each day he would come out and he would bring me fresh fruit and vegetables, and in return I would give him all my dirty clothes. And at low tide, when there was this bubbling spring on the beach, his wife would wash my clothes in the sand and then bring them back to me.
After that, it was time to continue your journey. By now you're through the islands of Vanuatu. How was that compared to the open ocean?
It was just spectacular. It was the most beautiful rowing I've ever done. For so long I'd been at sea, and there's beauty in that as well, but I think I'd had my fill by that stage. And so I was rowing along these coastlines, and there was these islands and villages, and I remember this scene rowing along, and there's no sign of life at all, and there's these, you look down and there's coral and there's fish swimming and there's these bougainvillea that are draping over and touching the water. And it was just this most beautiful thing, and I was there alone, no one to share it with, but I was very happy. And each time I got to a little village, I'd stop and the people would paddle out to me and they'd, "Is your motor broken? Is your mast broken? No, 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 this is all I've got. Oh, I'm very sorry, they would say. And they would give me gifts, and I would give them fishing line and lures in exchange, and it was this most amazing period.
And how close were you to Australia by then?
In that part of the Pacific, Vanuatu was the last island I could stop at before Australia. So I was envisaging another about 50 or 60 days to get back to Australia.
What happened?
So I left Vanuatu 5 days into the last leg of the journey. I'd been at sea in total for 265 days. I'd covered 7,500 nautical miles. And on day 5, I'd been rowing along quite pleasantly. It was sort of as expected. And that afternoon, I decided I'd hang the oars up a little bit earlier and I'd retire to the cabin. And the thing you must understand about these ocean rowing boats is that they are self-righting, which means they'll right if they're capsized, if their main hatch is closed, because there's air trapped inside the cabin. And so when things were rough, I would close the main hatch, which meant that the boat would self-right. Now, on day 5 of the last leg, 265 days at sea in total, conditions were relatively benign, nothing crazy. So I was lying in the cabin with the hatch open, the breeze was coming in, and then all of a sudden I heard this great crashing sound, the likes of which I hadn't heard in the whole journey, and I'd heard some pretty scary sounds. All of a sudden the boat was engulfed by this huge wave and tossed and turned over until she was upside down, and I found myself inside this cabin that flooded instantly, holding my breath. trying to process what had just happened in a split second. And all of a sudden I came to my senses and I realised that I was trapped in this cabin. I pushed the hatch open, swam out from the upturned hull and hung onto the side of the boat, treading water. And this was an extremely scary moment. This is like the worst possible scenario has just become my reality. This is the sort of thing that you fear for from when you're 14 to 24. You think that's the last thing I want to happen. And here I am and it's just happened. And so I was absolutely terrified.
Is there any way you could right the boat back up yourself or once it's capsized?
So that was the first thing I did was I tied a line to one side of the boat and I tried to pull the boat over. And I tried for probably half an hour, but the boat was so heavy that it wasn't coming back upright. And by this stage, it was getting dark. And I knew that if I flooded certain sections of the hull, I'd probably be able to ride it. But by this stage, it was getting dark and the waves were increasing. And so it was going to be too risky to continue to try and ride it. So I knew I had no choice but to hold on to that upturned hull for the duration of the night. And at that stage, I realised that my EPIRB, which is a beacon, emergency beacon that goes off in emergencies, was back inside the cabin and that would be going off, trying to send out a distress signal. Because it's in the water, it wouldn't be getting anywhere. And so I swam back under the boat, back into the cabin, and got in and got the EPIRB and came back out alongside the boat and held onto this EPIRB for my life. And I tied it around my wrist and then I climbed up onto the upturned hull and tied a line around my waist and to the boat. And this EPIRB was going beep, beep, flash, flash.
And that's immediately making contact back in Australia.
Correct, yeah. But did I know if they were picking up what I was sending out? I had no idea, but I was
And you were still on an upturned boat in the middle of the Pacific.
Yeah, yeah. So scary stuff.
And so what do you remember of that night?
As I sat on the boat, as the sun had completely set and it became pitch black, I was very cold. And all of a sudden I began to have these very negative thoughts, thinking this is it. And as each wave kind of broke over the boat and tried to push me off the hull, I fantasised about just letting go of the boat and being swept away with the next wave. But the whole journey, I'd prepared for extreme situations like this and I knew what to do. And so very quickly my mindset changed and all of a sudden I became very positive about the whole scenario. Despite the fact that I was cold and shivering, I imagined a big bonfire on the boat right there next to me and I began to sing songs and I just thought about my life and what I'd achieved up until then and realised that if anyone was going to get through this night, it was going to be me. And I set a few goals for that night. I was going to see the moon come up. I knew it would be a few hours, but the moon would come up and that was going to be the best moon I'd ever seen. Then after that, I knew that I just had to keep on holding on and that eventually the sun would come up. And once the sun came up, things were going to be fantastic. And I was going to get some food out of the boat and I was going to flood some sections of the hull and I was going to right it. And there was every chance I could continue on this journey, but I had to make it through that night. And
so what was the dawn like?
It was amazing. I was looking out to the east and it was pitch black for 12 hours. And then all of a sudden, I saw this faint, faint purple. And this purple turned into this deep, dark blue. And I realised instantly that I'd made it through the night. And the longest night of my life was over and that things were going to get better.
So at that point, you were still thinking maybe I can get the boat back up and continue?
Yes, yes. It was going to be difficult and I knew the whole cabin was flooded and I was going to be taking a big risk by continuing, but I didn't have any thoughts that there was going to be a ship come as soon as I needed it to. And so I was making plans to continue on the journey and to survive.
How did that change?
Not long after daybreak, just as the sun came up, I saw this black dot on the horizon and instantly I knew it was a ship and I knew that it was coming my way to rescue me. And I sort of fantasised about what sort of container ship it was going to be and what foreign port it was going to take me to, how this ship got bigger and bigger and bigger. And I realised that it wasn't just a container ship, it was actually a P&O cruise ship. And the side decks were lined with literally hundreds of people with binoculars and these telephoto lenses. And only then did I really become aware of my nudity. And so all of a sudden it was the biggest deal was not the fact that I wasn't rowing across the Pacific, it was the fact that I was nude and there was this cruise ship coming towards me with all these people. But obviously aside from that, I was quite thankful that safety was coming my way. And as soon as I saw that cruise ship, I realised that my journey had come to an end. Up until then, there was this unknown. Was I going to continue rowing? Was there going to be some small fishing boat come and help me right the boat? Was I going to continue? I didn't know. But as I saw that ship, I realised that I wanted to survive more than anything. And the jumping on that ship meant that I was going to survive. And so I knew I had no choice.
jumping on the ship, I'm not sure it would have been that straightforward. How do you get from the top of an upturned rowboat onto an enormous cruise ship in the ocean?
It's very difficult. I found this ship approaching, and by this stage it was quite rough and it was all happening, and the ship sort of came up near me and let the wind push it onto me until I was literally bobbing along the side of this great heaving ship. And as you can imagine, or you may have seen in videos, the waves that come up and down the sides of these big ships, and I was on this little tiny boat as this was happening. This was one of the most dangerous parts of the whole journey. And they drop a rope ladder through a hole in the side of the hull, probably 20, 25 feet down to the water's edge. And we bounce along until we get to this rope ladder. And I had one sort of chance to take a leap and grab onto this ladder. If I missed the ladder, would they have been able to get me again? I don't think so. So I took this great leap and I held onto this rope ladder, and all of a sudden I realised how weak I was due to the fact that I'd been clinging onto this boat all night. I grabbed onto this ladder and I pulled myself up rung by rung until I got to this hole in the side of the hull, and I climbed up into this hole, and there was this corridor full of staff and crew looking at me, and I was this nude rower that had just been rescued, and they wrapped some towels around me and they put me in a chair and they whisked me away to this hospital bed, basically, and I laid in this bed, and I was just sort of overcome by it all. The captain comes down, and I thought he was going to give me a dressing down for interrupting the cruise, and obviously I do apologise to the people on the cruise who were put out of their way for me, but the captain was a true gentleman, and I was able to thank him for saving my life, and he was happy I was alive, and he left. And then someone said to me, would you like to make a phone call, Tom? I said, I'd love to make a phone call. And so they hand me a phone and I call the home number, and Dad picks up the phone, and the first thing I said to him was, did you get any more sleep last night than I did? Because as soon as that beacon went off, I knew they would have been notified by EMSA. And he said, yeah, we got a couple of hours sleep, Tom. How about you? And I said, no chance for me. My parents were so relieved that the ordeal for them was over. They didn't have to worry anymore. And for me, it was over, for better or worse, and I was safe.
That cruise ship took you to New Zealand, and there you flew back to Brisbane. Who was waiting at the airport?
So I got back to the airport and I had these fantasies of catching the train home and then knocking on the door of my parents. But it wasn't to be. Somehow word got out that I was arriving, as these things do. So I got to the gate and I went through, and there was this horde of people and there was cameras and they were all chanting, Mahuta, Mahuta. And I saw my mum and dad and my sister and we embraced, and it was this most special thing.
It was even a woman from Penryn there.
It was amazing. I was scanning the crowd, looking at all these friends and family and onlookers, and then Mama Tualiki comes up and she gives me this flower necklace. She says, welcome home, Tom. Oh, amazing.
And she was just there by chance.
She happened to be in Brisbane.
So you'd done this incredible thing, but you hadn't reached the goal that you'd set out from 14 to do. Was that a challenge to make sense of?
I think it was a little bit of a challenge. There'd be times after I got back, I'd be driving down the road and all of a sudden it would overcome me and hit me. You didn't quite make it, Tom. You didn't quite make it, this voice in my head. But I think I came to terms with that pretty quickly. I think, as I mentioned on that first leg, I achieved all the things I wanted to achieve. I had this amazing adventure. I experienced the highs and lows. I got my time on the islands with these people. So I experienced all the things I wanted to achieve. There wasn't anything that I feel like I didn't get out of the journey. So the fact that I didn't quite make it to Australia, it would have been nice, but I don't think that would change who I am now.
And how long did it take for you to adjust to everyday life back in Brisbane?
It's been 2 years since I got back now. It took me a good year. I think we've all heard stories about athletes who sort of pit their whole lives towards a goal, whether it's an Olympic medal or a grand final. And then once they complete that, then all of a sudden their life loses meaning and they look in other places for meaning and they don't find it. So I had the same thing. It was just the same. It was very difficult. My whole life, my whole who I was pitted on rowing the Pacific. The fact that I didn't quite make it doesn't change the fact that I got back and I was totally lost. And I looked around this world and nothing looked familiar and nice. And I'd experienced how life could be lived. And here I was in the city, in the hustle and the bustle. And it was very hard to appreciate it and to sort of come back into life and to do normal things. Very, very difficult.
So has something taken its place of that goal, or what sort of adjustment have you learned to live without that kind of focus?
I'm a boat builder by trade. That's my thing I do. So I've just started a business doing classic boat restorations and repairs. So that's now my drive at the moment. It keeps me busy 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So I've got this goal now, which is to make this business work. And so that's really fun. But I don't think it'll be too long until the next idea about the next adventure comes to me, and then it'll be the same thing again. My goals will be set towards that.
And that noble Maywa, that boat you built and carried you so far across the ocean, where's she now?
Well, I got back after my rescue. Everyone asked me, what happened to Maywa? Did they pull it up on the cruise ship? Did she sink? What happened? It was none of those things. She was set adrift and she was made of wood, so she was going to float. And by that stage, I knew a fair bit about how the Pacific kind of worked, and I felt pretty sure that I would see her again. But I didn't know when or how or where, but I felt sure that we would be reunited again. And it was 2 minutes to midnight on New Year's Eve, and I feel this buzz in my phone. And I pull out my phone, and there's a Facebook message, and it says, "Hello, Tom, my name is Cindy Morawa from Papua New Guinea, and I have information on your boat." And I thought, is this real? And I texted her back straight away. We communicated over the next couple of weeks, and I found out that her family lives on an isolated island in the Louisiana archipelago, and that the boat had washed up on that island and that it was there. And so instantly I made plans to get out there to Papua New Guinea and find this boat. And so I jumped on a plane to Port Moresby, another plane to Alatau in the east, and then I hooked up with a local fellow there, and we walked the docks looking for an old trading boat that was heading that way. And we found this old captain, Captain Samuel, who agreed to drop us off on Paduina Island in the Calvados chain. And we jumped aboard, and it was this old timber trading boat that was full of rice and goods for these people in the islands. And I slept on the cabin top for, I think it was 2 days it took us to get to this island. And the second night I was asleep and someone woke me and I heard the revs of the engine go back. And, "Tom, this is Paduina." And this man in this boat comes out and says, "We're looking for Tom." So I jump aboard this boat and we go ashore. And this is an island that has no electricity, has not seen a white man like me in 10 years. And I arrived at this island and it was at night time and I said hello, and they've got one plastic chair in the village that they put on the beach for me, and the whole village of kids sat around me as I told them these stories about why I was there. The next morning we woke up and I was full of excitement. I was going to find my boat. And up until then I'd been led to believe it was in salvageable condition. And we jump in another dinghy and go to another little hamlet on the island, and as we pull up on the beach, I can see the outline of Maywa, but she's not as she should be. And we walk up the beach and I find Maywa there, and she's almost a total wreck. And for a second there, it broke my heart. I'd put so much effort into building this boat and we'd been companions for so long. And I met the man who found it on the reef. He was out sailing in his canoe and he found it, and it took him 5 hours to tow it back. All of a sudden, I felt really at peace with the fact that finally Tom's Pacific journey had come to an end. It was like a warm, firm handshake at the end. And up until then, there was still this big question mark of what was next. And so knowing that the boat was there and she was either going to be repaired by the locals or she was just going to slowly make her way back into the environment, I was really quite happy with that. And so that ends the journey across the Pacific.
Tom, absolutely amazing to hear your story. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Robinson was my guest on Conversations, and Tom now runs his own business in Brisbane, restoring old boats. This episode of Conversations was recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. It was produced by Jen Leake, and our executive producer is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.